Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from the March edition of Good Housekeeping magazine. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Our first article is called Sit, Stay, How to Stop Using Food as an Escape by Janine Roth. In the spring of 1982, I found myself on a payphone in the middle of the desert, frantically trying to rent a helicopter so I could leave the 10-day silent retreat I'd joined the day before. I hadn't realized I'd be required to spend 15 hours a day meditating, or that I wouldn't be allowed to talk or make eye contact with anyone the entire time. The guy on the phone asked me where I was. Joshua Tree National Park, I answered. There are no hot helicopter pads there, lady, he said, and if there were, you're talking a lot of money. I considered some alternatives to renting a helicopter, hitchhiking, walking, astral projection. None was feasible. I knew no one among the 150 people at the retreat, who I was now convinced were a cult of zombies, walking the grounds in a slow, meditative stupor. My dorm room, with 15 women sharing one bathroom, was crowded and stuffy. Despite a commitment to nonviolence, I was ready to inflict great harm upon the snorer in the cot next to mine. And the thought of spending 10 days stuck in my own mind felt like being locked up in a cramped cell with a crazy person. It'll be $2,500, the helicopter rental guy said, and since my salary as a sandwich maker at a health food store was $600 a month, leaving the retreat was out of the question. It was a good thing, too, because staying reminded me of a major life lesson. Good things can happen when you don't run away. Never underestimate the inclination to bolt, writes the Buddhist teacher Pema Chodron. I tell that to my students on the first night of the retreats I lead on overcoming emotional eating. They laugh. They think, me? I won't bolt. This thing with food has got me so down that I will do anything to resolve it. On the first night, they're too tired from traveling to think about escape. But by the second day, they're making plans to fly home. I tell them the helicopter story. I tell them that compulsive eating is a way we leave ourselves when life gets hard, distance ourselves from the way things are when they aren't what we want them to be. It's a way we keep ourselves from feeling pain we're afraid we can't stand. And wanting to get away from a retreat that's about ending compulsive eating, I tell them as a way of saying, I don't like that I have this obsession with food, but I don't want to do what I need to do to get past it. I thought I did, but now that I'm here, I've changed my mind. I'd rather go on another diet and pretend that this is about willpower than stay and do the work of knowing myself and discovering what I really believe. Although it seems as if ending the food obsession is what compulsive eaters want to do most, a part of us actually want to keep it. Obsession gives you something to do besides having your heart shattered by disappointment, conflict, or loss. You can become so focused on getting food in your mouth that you block out everything that's potentially painful. My troubles with food 3 decades ago evolved from the unconscious belief that I couldn't handle hurt. I used to think that the more I blocked out, the less hurt I feel when things fell apart. Being obsessed with food is a way of organizing our lives so that we never have to deal with the hard part, the part that happens between nursery school and death. I tell my students that ending the obsession with food is all about developing the capacity to stay in the present moment, to not leave themselves. Weight loss is the easy part, I say. Anytime you truly listen to your hunger and fullness, you lose weight. The hard part is learning not to bolt. There are many ways to leave: renting a helicopter, walking out the door, distracting yourself by thinking about something else, blaming your mother, starting an argument, comparing yourself with other people. dreaming about life in the future, recalling life in the past, never getting deeply involved, watching TV, working too hard, having sex, drinking, eating, spending your life trying to lose weight, resigning yourself to the endless struggle with food so you never have to discover who you are or what your relationships can be without the drama of food or what's really going on in the present moment. One irony about bolting from life through food or in other ways is that often it's not the present moment that's intolerable. The pain we're avoiding has already happened. We're living in reverse. When we think, I can't feel this, I won't feel this, hand me a cheeseburger, we're slipping into a former, younger self. Children deal with the pain of loss, abandonment, fear, or abuse by developing life-saving defenses that allow them to mentally escape a situation they can't physically leave, shutting down their feelings or turning to something that soothes them, like food. But the defenses that are life-saving for children are destructive for adults. We're no longer fragile or dependent. This kind of leaving isn't healthy or helpful. Of course, there's also pain in the present moment. This morning, I got a letter from one of my students who told me that her beloved elderly mother had suddenly plunged into dementia. My father is torn apart, she wrote. They've been married for 60 years, and I have no idea how I'm going to get through this. The answer I told her is, you stay with yourself. You sob, shout, feel as if your heart has a boulder crashing through it. You sit with your father. You listen to his sorrow. You get help from your friends. You notice that at the end of every day, you're still alive. And you especially notice that when you don't use food to shut yourself down, to leave your body, actually you feel more alive. Not bolting, being awake without being drugged by food, alcohol, work, sex, money, drugs, denial, or television, whatever you use to keep from looking at what's hard or hurtful, is definitely asking a lot. But staying where you are with what you're feeling is the first step in ending the obsession with food. Staying requires awareness of the desire to bolt, of the stories you tell yourself about the need to bolt. Staying means recognizing that when you want to bolt, you're living in the past. Staying requires being curious about who you actually are besides a collection of memories. Who are you when you sense yourself directly, immediately, right now? That's what you'll discover if you stay. The you who is not your past, not your habits, not your compulsions. When you get to know that person, anything becomes possible, even living through astonishing pain. You'll find then that feeling anything, including grief, is different from what you thought it would be. You'll find that you're living a bigger life, one that includes vulnerability, but also strength, one with a changed landscape, wider, richer, breathtaking, a life so wonderful you won't want to helicopter out of it. Now for the Ask Peggy column by Peggy Post. First question. My seventh grade daughter is upset because one carpool mom talks about scary current events on the way to school. How do I get the mom to lighten up? Here's Peggy's answer. Start by letting her know how your daughter feels. When Kelly hears about what's going on in the world these days, it sometimes scares her. Have you noticed anything like that with your daughter? Then ask her if she would steer the conversations to more positive topics in the morning. Let her know how much you appreciate her help. If nothing changes, you might need to find another way to get your daughter to school. Question. Every time we throw a party, one of my husband's single friends sticks around after all the other guests have left when we're in cleanup mode. Is there a polite way to ask him to leave? Here's the answer. Dropping hints to a guest who won't leave usually doesn't work, so you'll have to be direct. Say something like, "John, we've had a great time, but it's getting late, so we're going to have to kick you out. Thanks for coming." Walk him to the door and let him know that you've enjoyed his company. Then open the door and say goodnight. Question: do you confront a drinker? At work functions, a colleague always has one too many cocktails. People call her the office lush behind her back. You worry she's jeopardizing her job. Do you say something? Here's Peggy's answer. Yes, if she's a friend, it would be a kindness to tell her that her behavior is hurting her professional reputation. Don't expect an immediate response. She'll need some time to think about it. If you don't know her well, ask someone she trusts to speak to her. Our last question. A coworker often tells you that you look tired and you're offended. What do you do? Your choices are A, say so and ask her to keep her observations to herself. B, make a joke of it. That George Clooney really wears me out. Or C, slather an under-eye concealer. Peggy answer says, humor is usually the best way out of this kind of conversation. So B, make a joke of it, is the best choice. Or you can respond cheerfully in a way that's a bit more direct with a question and a comment. Tired? No, I feel great, thanks. She'll really likely realize she's put her foot in her mouth and will stop. Sandlot Dreams. The boys from the projects were strangers until our son invited them to our house, by Michael Rosen. The moment arrived each winter, in January or February, perhaps as late as March, when the sunlight suddenly was warm and bright and the flowers felt not far off. When they were still boys, our sons grabbed that moment. They hurried, baseballs and gloves ready, to the park across the street. The boys threw between snow mounds deposited by the Department of Sanitation, awkward throws lengthening to grace, warming to that promise of summer dreams. My wife and I first moved as a couple to New York's Lower East Side, drawn by its diversity. We adopted our two boys, and the park across the street became our yard. When our older son was 7, he did what now seems to have been inevitable and marched us onto the blacktop field, drawn by the sandlot game we'd seen over the years. The only white boy, he was assigned right field, and he invited his new teammates home afterwards for video games and snacks. He didn't know it was unusual to invite a crowd home, kids who didn't look like him, who lived in different circumstances. I didn't have the heart, nor did his mother, to suggest a limit to the number. 10 boys came. We returned to the field the next day, then the next, for all of summer and autumn, till it was too cold and dark, too early for baseball. But the boys kept visiting our house. On school nights, my wife made sure they left by 8 p.m., in time for our sons to get ready for bed, so we could read stories to the younger and let the older read on his own. The boys from the park didn't care about reading. Their mothers, we learned, hadn't read to them. They didn't have fathers at home. A few didn't have fathers alive. They didn't pay much attention to school. We decided a half hour of reading time was important, not only for our sons, but for the boys who came to our house. My wife began enforcing the half hour, and a few stopped visiting. But 5 boys in particular, regardless of their complaints, stayed on. Their reading started slow and awkward, but they kept at it and improved. By the middle of the next school year, these 5 black Dominican Puerto Ricans, 12 and 13 years old, were staying with us every weekend. My wife and I spoke often with them about the need to graduate from high school and finish college, because those with college degrees earn significantly more than those without. We believe that accomplishment and the pride they'd earn would enable them to break the cycle of poverty they had been born into for themselves, their children, and their children's children. We committed ourselves to their education. Each of them eventually moved in with us, finished high school, and started college. These boys started referring to us as their parents, and they became our sons. That first day of warming light each winter, when our boys rushed outside, meant our family had made it together through another year. Our sons might have been dreaming of baseball, but in the day's brightness, my wife and I also knew they had arrived closer to making their way in the world, giving us the most children can, a parent's joy in their happiness and growth. Our next article is on pet adoption, choosing the right pet for your family. Now that you've decided that you want a pet and you know which shelter to visit, it's time to narrow down your choice of pet. Here are a few considerations. Space. If you're in an apartment or small house with little or no outdoor space, a large dog might not be ideal unless you're willing to take your pet to a park or play area often. Cats or smaller companion animals are often a better fit for these situations. Lifestyle. If you're constantly on the go, cats or small companion animals may be a better choice because they are more independent than dogs. Realize, though, that they still need love and attention on a daily basis. Temperament. If you have your children in your household, you'll want a breed of dog that is even-tempered and less sensitive to touch and noise. Allergies. If you're unsure about your own or your family's allergic reactions to pets, spend time in the home of a pet-owning friend before you bring a dog or cat into your home. Why to choose a shelter or a rescue. When you see frolicking puppies or kittens in the window of a pet store, it's all too tempting to take that one home. But consider that animals available for sale at pet stores often come from breeding facilities that might not follow humane practices. Just as important, purchasing an animal from a pet store does not solve the overwhelming problem of animal homelessness. According to the Humane Society of the United States, nearly 16,500 to 22,000 homeless dogs and cats enter animal shelters across the country every day. And each year, 3 to 4 million animals are euthanized at shelters because there aren't enough good homes for them. Through its Think Adoption First program, Petco encourages people to consider adopting a homeless pet rather than purchasing an animal. Petco stores host adoption events every weekend where customers can meet representatives and pets from local shelters. Another resource is PetFinder.com, which directs people to local shelters and features more than 300,000 animals that are ready to go to new homes. A wide variety of pets are available at shelters, from puppies and kittens to senior pets and special need animals, all of which are deserving of a good home. Be prepared for their specific needs. For example, a senior dog might want a quieter household and may not adapt to a chaotic environment. Similarly, if you are considering a special needs pet, the household will have to accommodate the pet's physical condition. If you have wood or tile floors, there's a traction issue, and your pet may not be able to climb stairs. Spend time with an adoption counselor at your local shelter to determine which type of pet is best for your circumstances. Continuing with our pet articles, this article is about companion animals and more. Cats and dogs aren't the only option for family pets, of course. you can derive a great deal of joy in caring for small companion animals. These pets have unique personalities, are easy to care for, and inexpensive to maintain, and make for enjoyable family friends. Here are a few options. Birds. Parrots, parakeets, cockatoos, and cockatiels are beautiful and expressive. Parrots, for example, are colorful, wonderful companions that can bond closely with humans. All pet birds need a large, safe cage with lots of toys, nutritious food, and clean water. Clean the cage weekly and give them time out of their cages daily to stretch their wings and explore. Rabbits. These extremely social animals need lots of attention and like to be held and petted. They can be litter trained. Provide them with chew toys, balls, and tunnels, along with a nutritious, high-fiber diet. Chinchillas. These entertaining pets need a spacious cage for ledges, for jumping, plus an exercise wheel and chewable toys. Feed them high-quality pellet food. They also eat plants, fruits, and seeds. Guinea pigs. These gentle, friendly animals like to snuggle and are appropriate for all ages. Give them a cage with small obstacles and chewable items, and allow them some exercise time out of their cage. Ferrets. Best suited for older children and adults. These energetic, curious-minded pets love interacting with humans. They require a diet rich in protein and fat. Be sure to clean their cage on a regular basis. Gerbils. These easy-to-care-for pets love to explore and build, giving them digging and chewing materials such as paper tubes or brown paper bags. Feed them pellet food, grains, and seeds, and clean their cage regularly. Our last animal, hamsters. Great first pets. Hamsters love a habitat with bedding that they can burrow, hide, and chew. Give them an exercise wheel, along with a high-quality mix of berries, nuts, fresh fruit, and vegetables. Now for some tips and information from the Good Housekeeping Research Institute. Ask our expert. And here's the question that was asked of the Institute. I've heard that changes are coming in the way we use and pay for electricity. What's the latest? Here's their answer. In 49 states, $9.7 billion in federal and private money has been allocated to implement a smart grid, a system that will improve communication between provider and consumer. The goal? Smart meters will be installed in homes, and a separate display will show how much electricity is being used and a projection of its cost. Seeing use in real time can help alter habits. Say, for example, doing laundry when your rates are lower. With the current system, users typically pay a flat rate based on seasonal average prices. About 6% of U.S. households have smart meters already, with about 25% expected to have them by the end of next year. So ask your utility company about plans for your area. Here's their tip on the same subject. Until your utility company installs smart meters, consider a home energy monitor starting at about $100. They show real-time electricity use and cost in a similar way. With relatively small habit changes, you can save up to 20%. Here's a tip from the Good Housekeeping Research Institute. They ask, did you know? A staggering 50% of dogs and cats in the U.S. are overweight or obese. Check. If you can't easily fill your pet's ribs and his stomach hangs down, it's time to talk to your vet. Again, here's good housekeeping tips for wood touch-ups. First touch-up, How to undo water damage. On a wood table, water spills left unclean, wet glasses or vases, or hot dishes can leave behind unsightly white marks and rings when the moisture seeps into the finish. Fortunately, unless you had a spill linger on the surface for a long time, such as from a leaky planter, this damage can be repaired quickly. Start by placing a clean, thick towel on top of the stain. With your iron on a dry, low to medium setting, press over the towel, making sure the plate doesn't touch the wood for several seconds. The gentle heat will warm the finish enough to release the moisture into the towel. Lift the towel to check the results. Repeat as needed until the stain disappears. Polish and buff as usual. How to fix nicks and scratches. When keys are tossed or a fork is dropped on a finished wood surface, the marks left behind are especially obvious if the stain is scraped off and the lighter wood beneath is revealed. The solution to help conceal these scratches is nuts. No, really. Fresh walnuts or Brazil nuts have natural oils that help darken the wood to hide scratches. Crack the nut open, then rub the meat over the scratch in the direction of the grain of the wood. Buff with a clean, soft cloth. Repeat until the area blends in with the rest of the finish as much as possible. How to repair hairspray damage. Even when finely misted, the alcohol in perfume and hairspray can dissolve wood finishes. Suppress your cleanup instincts and let the droplets dry. Then dampen a cloth with water and dip it in a bit of ammonia. Lightly go over the stains to remove the sticky residue. Wipe dry. To smooth the finish, visit a home store and pick up some boiled linseed oil and powdered rotten stone, a mild abrasive. They'll know what it is, we promise. Mix the two into a thin paste and apply with your fingertips, gently working the stain into the stains in the direction of the grain. Wipe with a clean cloth. Apply a few coats of furniture polish and buff well. Make it easier next time. Place trays or trivets on the coffee table to hold drink glasses. Because they're bigger than coasters, they're more likely to be used. Consider Guardsman's Water Ring Remover Cloth, $3 at guardsmans.com. It rubs out water and even perfume stains. Keep scratch cover marking pens handy. Look for the results of our good housekeeping test of these in next month's issue. Some more good housekeeping tips on pets and travel. Airplane travel can be difficult for animals. If you must fly with your pet, you'll need to present a health certificate and proof of vaccinations. Avoid a pet tranquilizer unless your veterinarian recommends it. If boarding your pet at a kennel or veterinary office while you're away, carefully evaluate the facility for cleanliness, adequate space, supervision, and access to emergency care. Consider asking a trusted friend or relative to care for your pet while you're gone, or hire a professional pet sitter. We've run out of time for today's episode from Suits to Nuts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.